You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. An Oregon senator has introduced a bill that would undermine the constitutional right to political protest, state immigration laws, and give police spying powers beyond what is allowed by state law. But it appears he may have chosen the wrong community to challenge, and his bill came to committee in the wrong political climate. From Portland, Andrew Stelzer has the story.
He genuinely believes there's a need to create a crime of terrorism.
David Fedenke is with the Oregon ACLU.
And he wants that crime to include anything that might be even remotely related to acts of terrorism.
Oregon Bill 742 would expand the definition of terrorism to include anybody who participates in an act to disrupt commerce, transportation, and education, among other things. The penalty for any act of terrorism? 25 years to life.
The original bill was so overbroad, it was quite ridiculous. It would have made it a crime of terrorism for some high school students to have a food fight in a school cafeteria, as long as one of them intended to disrupt the educational institution.
Last year, Portland police decided not to conduct roundups and interviews of innocent Middle Eastern men because it violated state law. The decision thrust the Portland police into the spotlight because it went against the orders of Attorney General John Ashcroft. Senator John Minnis objected at the time, claiming that the government needed increased powers to fight terrorism. And with the current crackdown on civil liberties and the Patriot Act, news of Minnis introducing Bill 742 didn't seem to surprise people marching for peace in southeast Portland.
I think it's pretty fitting. I mean, it doesn't sound too surprising to me, considering everything else that they've done, everything else they will do and they can do. None of that surprises me at all.
On Monday, a hearing was held to discuss the bill. Over 300 people came to testify against it. Only 9 were allowed to speak.
I'm asking again if everybody would please exit the room who does not have a chair. We're not going to begin. I'm hoping we can all work together and do this civilly.
Can we ask again for a bigger room?
How do we testify if we're downstairs?
Senate Bill 742 may have come to committee at an unfortunate time. Portland Senator Ginny Burdick said that the massive political protests which have been going on for the past few months, and especially the past week, meant the issue of legal political protest was fresh in everybody's mind. Plus, the community was already organized around issues of civil liberties.
It was good timing because the protests were on people's minds, and there was not a single person signed up at that hearing in favor of this bill. It was all people who were very alarmed about the infringement on civil liberties, and they were all opposed to the bill. So it was, in a sense, it was good about the timing because the opponents did a very good job of mobilizing people.
Oregon laws also make Minnis' proposed bill uniquely illegal in 2 other ways. Again, Fedenke from the ACLU.
Oregon law currently has 2 provisions that are unique in the country. The first, which prohibits state and local police from engaging in political, religious, or social surveillance of individuals or organizations unless there is evidence that those individuals or that organization is or may be involved in criminal activity. The second law is prohibits state and local police from enforcing federal immigration law unless they have already arrested someone for another crime. Senate Bill 742 would make an exception to both of those laws.
Minnis is also a Portland police officer, but even the police chief has written a letter which objects to the part of the bill which give the police spying powers and change immigration laws. The chief has not objected to changing the definition of terrorism. The committee which votes on the law consists of 3 Democrats and 3 Republicans. Ginny Burdick said she is determined that the bill will not pass, and while she believes Minnis had good intentions, he and many other legislators have gone overboard.
I believe that we're in a situation in this country where we're over the line in infringing upon people's civil rights, all in the name of fighting terror. It would be very ironic if, in the name of fighting terror, we were to infringe upon those very rights that we defend as a country.
And Senator Burdick raises another question. Do we really need harsher sentences in the first place?
When you get into activities that we would all agree are terrorist activities, I think the sentences are more than adequate as they are now. I mean, we're talking about very, very serious crimes. I just feel like our laws are more than adequate to deal with real terrorist activity in this country. And I would rather be spending our time on other issues that are really important to Oregonians, like funding our schools.
Senator Minnis has taken the bill back to work on it before resubmitting. Minnis says there will be changes made to some of the definitions of terrorism, but he has no plans to change the increased spying powers granted to police. For Peace Watch, this is Andrew Stelzer reporting from Portland.
Gore Vidal, the author of a new collection titled Dreaming War, Blood for Oil and the Cheney Bush Junta, has been watching the current administration's key players and their global behavior, which he likens to the tactics of ancient Rome. Vidal recently discussed this and other matters, including the invasion of Iraq, on Pacifica Station WBAI's Wake Up Call with Peace Watch producer Robert Knight.
Gore Vidal, why do you think Iraq is being invaded?
Oil. We're not allowed to say that anything is a conspiracy, because if we do say that, we're supposed to be crazy and believe that in flying saucers is an abduction by aliens. So I've substituted the word coincidence for conspiracy. It is a coincidence, generally unknown to the American people, that the administration, the great offices of state, are filled by oil and gas people who still have connections with the oil and gas business. There is Bush Sr., who is Carlyle Group, which is, and he's very active in the oil business, as that group is. His son is Harkin Oil. Cheney is Halliburton, which already has a big contract for repairing the worn-out, by and large, Iraqi equipment. And they will make billions out of it. Condoleezza Rice is Exxon Texaco. Gail Norton, Secretary of the Interior, is British Petroleum. And it is said that Rumsfeld has had connections with Occidental Oil, particularly through their Colombian connection, which he is. Secretary of Defense was very helpful to protect their pipelines.
You say in your book, an unexpected joy of this abstract war has been the emergence of our elfin Defense Secretary Rumsfeld as a major TV comic. I take it that he, too, is a part of what you call the Cheney-Bush junta. And, by the way, why do you say Cheney-Bush instead of Bush-Cheney?
Well, Cheney is plainly the brains of it. I don't think even Mr. Bush's most passionate admirers, and I've not met any, but I'm sure that they exist, would say that he was quite up to really staging a world war, or at least the beginnings of one, and to put into operation such a vast plan, because the target in all this is Eurasia. Eurasia is that section east of Russia, which is the largest and richest section of the world as far as gas, oil, and minerals go. And it comprises the former Muslim republics of the old Soviet Union. We have our eye on them. We have our eye on not only on Iraq, which has the second largest oil reserves in the world. We also have it on what is known as Caspian oil, which are the old Muslim republics, sometimes called Eurasia, which is a vast, 75% of the world's population lives there. All those countries that end in Stan, like Uzbekistan. We have our eye on that. Why? Because Cheney asked for a report on world gas and oil, a sensible thing to do a couple of years ago, got the bad news that the entire world was going to be running out of gas and oil by 2020. Being a thoughtful businessman looking ahead, why shouldn't we get our hands on that? He who has that oil and gas will control all energy on the planet until hydrogen comes in, and they will do their best to make sure that doesn't come in until they've made every dollar they can out of this. That's the game.
In your book, Dreaming War, you put it in a deeper historical context than the news channels, the commercial news channels, tend to do. You hark back to the initiation of the Truman Doctrine. You even go so far back as to compare American behavior to Roman behavior. Can you give us a bit more historical perspective on that?
Well, it was ours most resembles what the Roman Empire did. Their technique was to they didn't necessarily put their flag over other countries' capitals, but they put their courthouses and legal system and troops and police in far-flung countries. Then, when they wanted more territories, more property, they would say that one of their friends, allies, was being attacked by, let us say, the kingdom of Parthia. And Parthia must submit to Rome. This is a holy war. This is a war for the empire. A war for the emperor. And they would use these pretexts, and they're precisely the same language that we are using today. So it's that is the historical context. Empires tend to behave pretty much the same way, particularly if there's no information for the general public. Now, in Roman times, they did not have faxes, and they didn't have satellites, and they didn't have TV. And the people really basically knew nothing at all except for a few rumors that they heard. We have the means of informing everybody about everything, putting it to a national vote. Do we really want to conquer Iraq, Iran, this, that? They don't dare do that, but they do have the means of disseminating propaganda. This evil man who shoots everybody, that story, which everybody believed at the time of the first Gulf War, that they'd gone in and thrown premature babies out of their baby carriages and let them freeze on the floor. That all turned out to be propaganda done by a rather good and very effective advertising agency in New York, and repeated for them by a little actress who happened to be the young daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador to the United States. Everybody fell for that. There's no length to which these people won't go in the interest of profits.
Gore Vidal is the author of Dreaming War, Blood for Oil and the Cheney Bush Junta, published by Thunder's Mouth Press. He spoke with Robert Knight on WBAI's Wake Up Call. Several weeks ago, the Reverend Walter Fauntroy, pastor of New Bethel Baptist Church, founder of the Congressional Black Caucus, led spiritual leaders from every spiritual community in the U.S. to Baghdad to negotiate with Iraqi leadership to find an alternative to war. While in the U.S. Congress, Fauntroy also served on two House banking committees and was instrumental in developing policy for U.S. banks and the International Monetary Fund. Peace Watch spoke with Fauntroy today about his negotiations in Iraq, which he believes might have averted the invasion of Iraq, and the Bush administration's surprising response upon his return to the U.S.
We went to Baghdad in an 11th-hour attempt to avert the war. We did so because while most people are aware of two issues in dispute between the United States and Iraq, namely that of the UN resolution which called for the disclosure of all weapons of mass destruction that they've had in their possession and the assurance that they're not producing them. And secondly, everyone knows that oil is at the heart of this matter as well, inasmuch as two-thirds of all the oil produced in Iraq is sold to U.S. companies. The third issue, however, which few people are aware of, is that of the dollar versus the euro as the reserve currency for international trade. 2 years ago, when the euro became a reality, Saddam Hussein stuck a dagger into the heart of the U.S. economy for decades to come when he adopted a policy of requiring that all oil purchased from Iraq must be purchased in euros, which meant that U.S. companies had to go to France and Germany and buy euros with dollars in order to get the oil without which we cannot survive. That's an issue because the fact is that since World War II, the U.S. dollar has been the reserve currency for all international trade. Most oil that is purchased in the world is purchased only through the possession of dollars. Indeed, every major commodity traded in the international market is traded in U.S. dollars. That's why we call it the almighty dollar.
So we're talking about a significant change of doing business in the world market.
That's right. If you're talking about control of the world economy. And the fact is that with respect to the dollar, because it is in such great demand for anyone who wants to deal with international trade, and having dollars, anyone who wants to buy oil, anybody who wants to buy automobiles, airplanes, must get dollars out of their own currency. So they must come to the people who have dollars, and they exchange them. More important, when the United States government runs deficits and must spend money that they don't have in terms of taxes, the United States government turns to these people who have dollars outside, and they invest substantial portions of the $3 trillion that have been printed by our Federal Reserve and are now abroad back into the U.S. economy or the U.S. deficit, because the investors know it's the safest investment you can make, because our government will tax the U.S. citizens and then pay them interest on the dollars they loan.
So when Saddam Hussein issued this policy that any oil from Iraq had to be purchased with euro dollars, and then the U.S. had to go through France and Germany in order to get their euro dollars, what kind of effect did that have on the U.S.?
Well, in the first instance, when Iraq did that, then Iran began to say, well, you know, that's a pretty good idea. When they said that, the Russians said, you know, that's not a bad idea. And the Chinese said, you know, that's not a bad idea. And if all of them switched to the euro, the U.S. dollar would become monopoly money, and our economy would crash. That was what is at stake, and that is probably the basic reason that they want to take over the fields and revert to the U.S. policy to the U.S. dollar policy that was, which is true for all oil in the world, including that of Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and Iran and elsewhere. And what happened as a result of our visit there and my wrestling with Tariq Aziz for an hour and a half was that we reached an agreement that is really a deal that no head of the Federal Reserve Board in America, no Wall Street person, and no corporate mogul in the United States could refuse. He said, we'll do three things. First, of course, we will, if it's the cost of not tearing our country up, we will reveal where all of the weapons of mass destruction that the U.S. gave us.
Now, Tariq Aziz is in Saddam's inner circle.
He is the foreign minister, number two man, and the face of Iraq to the world. Secondly, tell the American economy and those who understand what you're talking about, Congressman Fauntroy, that we will switch back to the dollar as the basis for trade for our oil. Tell them, in addition, we will give a deep discount to U.S. companies in the purchase of our oil.
Now, did you get any of that in writing?
Yes. Yes.
You have a document.
No. I took it down. First of all, you must understand that what we were doing and what I was doing was back-channel negotiations. The idea was that I took those notes. I was asked to bring it back to the United States to meet directly with Powers leadership, and then have them to go through and see what conditions they'd want to add or subtract. Then I was to go back and meet with him. And if it met their approval, we were to stand up in Iraq and say, are willing to do the following things if the United States will respond. At that point, knowing what the United States response would be, there would be no war.
And so what happened? Did you take this information back to the state, to Colin Powell's office?
Let me just say, before I tell you that, let me say that in addition, all we ask is that you remove the troops, that you send the medical ships in and help treat the people who have been devastated over the last 12 years, and that you help us rebuild. I came back with that. And when I got to the State Department, I was told it's too late. We've already decided that we're going to do a resolution on Thursday, and whatever the UN votes, we're going to move to start the war on that weekend.
Now, whose office did you speak with?
I spoke to the chief of staff of Colin Powell, Mr. Larry B. Wilkerson, and the Undersecretary of State for Middle East Affairs, both of whom had met with us the day before we left. Because we met with the Iraqi UN ambassador, Muhammad al-Duri. We met with the deputy general secretary of the UN, because Mr. Annan was not in town, in New York. And then we came to Washington to meet with the chief of staff and the undersecretary of state for Middle East Affairs, and telling them what we were going to do. They wished us well. We went. We came back. When we came back, we were told it's too late.
The Reverend Walter L. Fauntroy, pastor of New Bethel Baptist Church, founder of the Congressional Black Caucus. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. If you'd like to support this type of programming, we invite you to visit our website at www.pacifica.org and make a pledge on our secure website. Dozens of journalists, including CNN's Nick Robertson and Pacifica Radio's Jerry Quickly, have been expelled from Baghdad over the past several weeks. Late yesterday, veteran war correspondent Phil Smucker was also asked to leave, but not by the Iraqi government. Smucker had been traveling with the 1st and 2nd Battalions of the 5th Regiment of the U.S. Army. During a report to CNN, he was cautioned not to be too specific in his report, lest he accidentally give out sensitive military information. Shortly thereafter, he had his satellite phone and computer confiscated and was put on a truck to be escorted by military personnel out of the country. Peace Watch spoke with Smucker's father, retired 2nd Lieutenant John Smucker, today regarding his son's expulsion from Iraq.
Heard only that he was detained by the military police on Wednesday, approximately, David called me from Boston at 1:40 p.m. Wednesday, and he had heard at that point that Philip had been detained by the military police, and his satellite phone and his computer had been taken away from him. He had been put in a military vehicle and was being escorted from wherever the 1st Marine Expeditionary Force had been, and he had been with them, to Kuwait. But no one has heard anything at all about their whereabouts since that time. That was Wednesday at 1:40 p.m.
And so the Washington Post basically said that he was being expelled because he was actually reporting on information that was too specific that might have compromised the military's plans or strategy or approach at that time. Are you surprised to hear that?
Well, not only surprised, but if you've read the rest of the article, Howard Kurtz said that CNN and NPR played the tapes back for David Scott of the Christian Science Monitor, and there is nothing that Philip said, according to the people who have heard the tapes, the audio tapes, that had not been printed in or said on various newspapers, TV, etc., radio, at least the day before, if not more. I mean, every day the Washington Post prints War in Iraq section, section 2 of the front part, and on the back they have a map which describes where every unit of the military is, and the 1st Marine Expeditionary Force has been, I thought, near Karbala. Philip mentioned that, and Carol Costello of CNN apparently cautioned Philip not to say anything that would jeopardize anybody. And he's been in this business for 18 years. For 18 years.
Mm-hmm.
He started out in Cambodia, Laos. He was in Shanghai at Tiananmen Square. That's not a war, of course, but then he's covered Bosnia, Kosovo, Haiti. Pardon me, I need to go back. Haiti. Afghanistan, all last year in Afghanistan, and now this year,
yes,
in Iraq.
Mm-hmm. And I'm also reading where he also has reported for a variety of publications, including
yes,
the Daily Telegraph, the U.S. News and World Report, and the Washington Times. The point being that he is not a novice journalist when it comes to reporting conflicts and wars and that sort of thing.
Howard Kurtz said in his article that David Scott of the Christian Science Monitor said that Philip is not a novice, that he has been around the horn for 18 years in one form or another, and he would never say anything to jeopardize the military with whom he happened to be or himself. Never.
Well, then why then do you suppose, Mr. Smucker, that your son was expelled under the auspices of having exposed some sensitive material?
Two reasons, possibly. One, he was not embedded. And the second reason was that, and I don't know if anybody wants to hear this, but I'm a father and I was in the military myself just after the Second World War, and I know that sometimes things get a little tight, and I had some difficulties with not only my men, but with my superior officer, who got to eventually be a lieutenant general. I was discharged as a second lieutenant to go back to college. But I would say that some general, I was told, in Qatar or Qatar, how you pronounce it, heard a radio broadcast, and Philip was on it. Maybe he saw the TV thing with CNN. And this general maybe was having a bad night's sleep the night before, or a stomach ache, or maybe he had diarrhea, or you know, whatever. But he said, get rid of that kid. Philip's 41. He's no kid. Anyway, that's the other option as I see it. I don't think it had anything to do with the fact that I happen to be for peace. I mean, Philip knows that. In fact, he told me not to climb over the White House wall, you know, fence. He said, that's dangerous, Father. He said, but you can sit in at the main intersection of Alexandria City, which I did, and was, of course, arrested.
So, Mr. Yeah. Smucker, sometimes they say that the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. Now, is that perhaps the case with your son? Is it perhaps something that he was reporting that the general didn't like,
mm-hmm.
that may have had a sort of a flavor or feel that was against the war?
Well, he did say, my wife and I heard the broadcast on NPR at about 5:15 Wednesday morning, and his last comment before the NPR fellow signed off with him was, and the Marines may find, I'm paraphrasing, but the best I can recall, my wife wrote it down, the Marines may find, as we get closer to Baghdad, that if the Iraqis do not use chemical warfare or gas, that in fact they may not have had it available to them, which will rather disprove one of the reasons Mr. Rumsfeld and Mr. Bush and others thought we should go in. And I think they're called in some circles weapons of mass destruction. Philip said that on the radio.
He did.
Yes.
Okay. And so in your suppositions as to why he was expelled from the country by the Pentagon, do you suppose that might have been one of the reasons?
Possible.
Well, now his cameraman, Andy Nelson, Nelson, was not expelled?
Not expelled. And David Scott, who was the foreign editor for the Christian Science Monitor, said, and I don't know if you can believe this. I don't know if I believe it. Andy Nelson was told that he could stay, but he had to stay 3 miles behind the headquarters unit, and this is an editorial on my part, so he could be picked off by a sniper. I mean, I am angry, angry, angry. Why would they put this photographer in such jeopardy? He had to remain. Somebody should have their heads examined.
Mr. Smucker, you're a former military man.
Well, I was only for 3 years, Ms. Brown, and then I went to a seminary and I became an Episcopal clergyman.
Hmm.
Well, in between, I sold dynamite for the DuPont Company for 3 years. I had some involvement. Yes,
you have a past. Well, how do you feel about the fact that the Pentagon actually expelled your son from a country that's not run by the Pentagon? I mean, I understand that the U.S. is a superpower, but I was a little surprised that they could expel a reporter.
No, I'm not surprised at that, Ms. Brown, because the military is trying to do a job, even though I disagree with their premises. They are in control of their own destiny, and so...
But he was not embedded with the military.
That's true. But I think that they felt they had a perimeter that they were responsible for, and anybody within that perimeter, however wide-ranging it was, therefore fell within their jurisdiction and their purview.
John R. Smucker, father of Philip Smucker, veteran war correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, expelled from Iraq by the Pentagon on late Tuesday or early Wednesday morning. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. Our associate producer is Angelique Chauffard. We had production assistance from Adil Hamad of KPFA, Jim Bennett, Pete Caracas, Keith Shaljian, Elise Finwall, and Benta Berklin. Thanks to Pete Caracas, RadioForAll.net, and Shane Rock at WebActive.com for web help. Special thanks also to our consulting producer, Sam Husseini. If you'd like to support this type of programming, we urge you to visit Pacifica.org and make a pledge through our secure online website, or you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street, Northwest, Washington, D.C., 2009. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.